Welcome to another Psych Matters podcast from the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Psychiatrists. Psych Matters is a series of discussions on training and practice issues facing trainees and fellows of the college and other important topics in mental health. Cognitive impairment is a core feature of mood disorders, depression and bipolar disorder, and is evident across a range of domains: memory, executive function, attention, and processing speed. Research shows that cognitive impairment persists into recovery and relates to problems in occupational and psychosocial functioning. International task forces have thus identified cognition as an important treatment target in mood disorders in attempting to improve overall recovery for people with mood disorders. This podcast covers the importance of clinicians considering cognitive functioning in individuals with mood disorders, as well as practical strategies for assessing and treating cognitive problems.
We acknowledge Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples as the First Nations and the traditional owners and custodians of the lands and waters known as Australia, and Māori as Tangata Whenua in Aotearoa. We honour and respect the elders past and present who weave their wisdom into all realms of life.
Well, welcome to this podcast on cognitive problems in mood disorders. And I'm here at the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Psychiatrists Conference, the New Zealand branch conference in Queenstown. I'm Richard Porter. I'm a professor of psychiatry at the University of Otago in Christchurch and also a clinician. And I have with me Dr. Katie Douglas, who's a senior research fellow at the Department of Psychological Medicine in Christchurch and also a clinical psychologist. And we've spent many years researching the cognitive problems associated with depression and bipolar disorder. I think it's an issue that's becoming increasingly recognised, but I still think many clinicians are less aware of the degree of this issue for their patients and the effect it has on their functioning. So maybe, Katie, if you could begin by discussing for us a little bit how common these sorts of problems are for people with mood disorders.
In short, they're very common, but in long, cognitive problems are very established as a core feature of depression and bipolar disorder. And how common they are depends on how you actually define what cognitive impairment is. We've done research looking at rates of impairment in depression and bipolar disorder, and they can range from 20% to 60%, depending on what definition you use. It also depends on various factors. Firstly, whether someone's got bipolar or unipolar depression, and typically bipolar depression, the impairment's a little bit worse. Also on the severity of depression symptoms, also taking into account things like premorbid functioning, looking at estimates of IQ has an impact, and also whether you're looking at objective cognitive impairment, so that's impairment seen on cognitive testing or neuropsychological testing, or whether we're asking subjectively about how people are struggling in different cognitive domains.
Thanks. So there's a number of issues there, and maybe I could get you to talk a little bit more on the phase of the illness. You talked about depression, but what about when people are euthymic, when they're recovered from depression or they're in between episodes in bipolar disorder?
So definitely you see a more marked cognitive impairment when people are acutely unwell in depression and in the depressed phase of bipolar disorder. But actually there's a lot of research looking at euthymic samples or remitted samples showing that there's persisting impairment in cognitive function. And this is still impairment at a level that would be having an effect on people's lives.
And can you comment on the course of this? You know, what happens as people progress in their illness and how does that vary from one person to another?
That's a complex question. It depends on the profile of impairment, I think, and that's what we're really trying to understand is why people become cognitively impaired initially. For some people, it does seem like it's maybe a scarring effect, and the more episodes that people have, the worse the impairment. For other people, it might be more fluctuating, and it might relate to things like anxiety or rumination more so that improves when those features are targeted.
Yeah, thanks. And the subjective, objective differences. Some patients complain bitterly of cognitive problems, but on testing don't have objective problems, and other people are the other way around. Can you comment a bit more on that issue? Because that's problematic for clinicians to know how to deal with that.
Yeah, so that's something that doesn't relate So the objective and the subjective impairment often don't relate that strongly to each other, even though you might think that if someone's talking about cognitive problems, about things like struggling in memory or struggling to focus attention, that this would show up on cognitive tests, but often it doesn't. And obviously you'll be aware of the paper that you looked at this in the discrepancy between objective and subjective impairment. And that relates to clinical factors. So for some people who think that they're very cognitively impaired but actually are performing okay on objective neuropsychological testing, this might relate to things like age, severity of illness, duration of illness.
And perhaps the most consistent finding is that residual symptoms of depression do seem to correlate with the difference between subjective and objective impairment, such that people who are slightly still depressed are more likely to perceive themselves as impaired. But it correlates better in some ways with functioning, the subjective impairment, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that actually what I remembered I wanted to say was that sometimes the subjective feeling that you're struggling in cognitive domains might also relate to a decline from a previous level of functioning. So if you've got someone who's been in quite a cognitively demanding job, and then experiences a depressive episode and is struggling to get back to that job, that might be an indication that you might be able to pick that up on subjective testing, and because obviously they're experts in their kind of cognition over time, and if they can't get back to that cognitively demanding job, it might be because there has been a decline.
And would it be true to say that perhaps the way that we test objective cognitive function is not valid, or the real life situation where people are more distracted by extraneous stimuli and there's perhaps less controllability of the cognitive load?
Yes, and I think that's definitely seen in people maybe who have cognitive impairment that's more related to rumination. So you might see someone who is cognitively very capable, they come in for a neuropsychological test and they actually do very well on their tests, but they still talk of having real difficulty in their day-to-day life in terms of being able to concentrate, and that might be as a result of internal processes like rumination getting in the way of that.
Perhaps processing interpersonal issues in the workplace, etc., might also impair cognitive functioning in that sort of situation. It creates a difficult situation for clinicians because the question then is, how do they actually ask about and screen for significant cognitive difficulties and then identify which of their patients have got problems with cognition? Can you comment on that a little bit?
I think that's something that we're really working on, is actually just creating more awareness for clinicians that this is a core feature of mood disorders. So for clinicians, even just having it on your radar when you're assessing someone with a mood disorder is very useful. And I'm aware that clinicians don't have time to do a comprehensive neuropsychological testing battery on their patients. So it's about how you still can assess that in a timely manner. And so there are some questions you can ask within an assessment that would start tapping into some of the cognitive domains that are often affected in mood disorders.
And I always find that difficult, to find the right wording that patients understand to express cognitive functions and thereby to ask them what the problems are. So have you some thoughts on that?
Because, yeah, cognitive can be interpreted in a lot of different ways. It can be better or more helpful to ask about specific examples that people might be experiencing in their day-to-day life. So, for example, if you've got someone who you think might be having problems with memory, asking things like whether they forget people's names or whether they miss appointments or whether they lose things around the home often, questions like that that they can actually say yes or no to.
I would be answering yes to most of those. Are there some other questions you ask about particular aspects of cognitive function?
Yeah, so I guess the other domains that are often impaired in mood disorders are executive functioning, so questions around not being able to pay attention or being distractible or not being able to plan ahead. So even things like cooking a meal is actually something that requires planning and doing multiple things at once. Psychomotor speed is also often affected in mood disorders, so asking about whether they feel like they're a bit more slowed in doing tasks or whether other people have noticed that as well. And I guess the sustained attention, things like reading books, asking if they tend to read the same paragraph over and over because they can't kind of concentrate for a long period of time, can be helpful.
Thank you for that. And that's really useful to have a framework for screening these cognitive problems. But of course, the next question is, what do you do about that when you get a patient who is complaining of cognitive issues? And another question is, when would you refer people for detailed neuropsychological testing? I think perhaps in the first instance, there's a number of steps we should go through. And the first one is probably to establish whether this person is actually better. And Katie and I have looked into this issue of to what degree do depressive symptoms correlate with cognitive problems. It's not to a massive degree, or at least it's been difficult to show that the two are closely correlated in the research. But if you see a patient in your clinical practice who's still significantly depressed, then obviously that is an area that should be targeted. You should be trying to get the treatment as optimal as possible and treat residual symptoms. And the same with, of course, in bipolar disorder, residual depressive symptoms and even threshold depressive symptoms are incredibly common. So that, of course, has to be your first target for treatment. The second thing I think we need to be very aware of is the effects of medication on cognitive function. And perhaps the culprit that I would highlight is anticholinergic medications. So, for example, if somebody was on an anticholinergic antipsychotic like quetiapine, that could potentially cause problems with cognition. Anticholinergic antidepressants like paroxetine is slightly more anticholinergic than the rest of the SSRIs. Other medications that might interfere with cognition, I've seen a number of people with bipolar depression on propranolol, for instance, for prophylaxis of migraine. And sometimes it's prescribed by general practitioners for anxiety. So I think a really thorough review of the medication and a discussion with the patient about what is necessary and perhaps some cautious and careful reduction in medications, particularly those that are anticholinergic. The second issue that I think is really important, and there is some data on this in bipolar disorder, suggesting that if the results of the studies that Katie is talking about would show cognitive impairment, if they were co-varied for sleep problems, then the people who are actually sleeping well don't get the cognitive problems. And so sleep is an incredibly important issue in bipolar disorder as a whole for many, many reasons, not least the issue of cognitive function. So I think a careful discussion of sleep issues with the patient and a careful working with them to try and improve sleep, not just the amount of sleep, because hypersomnia, of course, is an issue, but the regularity of sleep, trying to get that circadian rhythm regularized. Just on the subject of sleep, of course, screening for sleep apnea is an incredibly important issue as well. And then the third thing I would highlight, and I don't want to talk for too long on this subject, but the third thing I would highlight is metabolic issues and inflammation and centripetal adiposity and metabolic syndrome are all potently anti-cognitive. So they all cause significant cognitive problems. And we've had quite a lot of discussion at this conference about the metabolic side effects of medications and the problem of people with bipolar disorder being much more susceptible to metabolic problems. And I think perhaps we are at a point, we are ready as psychiatrists to prescribe metformin, for instance, at a much earlier stage, not just to treat those metabolic issues, but the probable effects of them on cognition and possibly mood as well. Obviously, there are some new medications, but they're not for weight gain and for regulating metabolic issues and weight, but they're not really widely available at this point.
I hope that you're enjoying this podcast. If you have a topic suggestion or would like to participate in a future episode of Psych Matters, we'd love to hear from you. Please contact us by email at psychmatters.feedback@ranzcp.org.
So I think those are the main things we would screen for and we would try to address. But despite that, I think we're going to be left with a high percentage of people still with significant perceived or tested cognitive problems. And the question then is, firstly, who would we send for a detailed neuropsychological assessment? And I think at this point, if the resources allow, we would send all these people for that. And that would at least give us some sense of the profile of their cognitive problems. You know, what are their strengths? What are their weaknesses? What areas might be helped by strategies, by cognitive practice, etc.? But once we've done that, we probably are looking at trying to help this person in the relative absence of evidence on psychological treatments. I still think we can do things to try and help people in this situation. So, Katie, could I pass back to you to discuss some basic cognitive strategies that you as a psychologist might use?
Yeah, and I think before starting to think about specific cognitive strategies, thinking about sleep, as you say, using simple kind of sleep hygiene strategies that you'd use in CBT or IPSRT is a very good start. And related to the metabolic factors that you also mentioned, trying to make sure that people are active, and because there's research showing that physical activity as well as helping with sleep might help with cognitive function as well. So that's something that we would obviously offer in psychological interventions for mood disorders anyway. Thinking more specifically about improving cognitive functioning, one factor seems to be actually just helping to improve cognitive confidence. Often if people feel like they're struggling in cognitive domains, it becomes a vicious cycle where they start avoiding doing cognitively challenging tasks in their day-to-day life because they're fearful that they won't be able to do it or that other people might respond negatively. So kind of using a CBT approach to help cognitive confidence by reframing cognitive difficulties or frustrations as a challenge and encouraging them to expose themselves to cognitively demanding tasks. And often the metaphor of relating it to like going to the gym for physical health, it's important to actually improve your cognitive health too by training your brain and challenging your brain. It can also help in that domain also just by providing psychoeducation to the patients about how common it is for people to have cognitive problems, because often people feel pretty alone in their struggles in this domain, and often it might be because in a mental health service they're not really asked specifically about these questions. If someone has a more ruminative profile, so if it seems like they're actually performing okay on neuropsychological tasks, but they feel like they can't function because anxiety or rumination is getting in the way, there's actually pretty good evidence for a simple technique called attention training and the impact that that can have on rumination, on cognitive function, and also on residual depressive symptoms. So this is a technique that was developed by Wells as part of metacognitive therapy, which essentially involves getting people to listen to a sound file, which there's plenty freely accessible on YouTube. And it's a 5-minute task where you're guided to listen selectively to different sounds. And it's thought that training your attention to focus on different sounds will then be able to translate into people being able to disengage from problematic thinking and being able to shift their attention. If there's still cognitive problems after trying those kind of broader techniques for cognitive impairment, then you might start considering a more kind of pure cognitive remediation approach. And these approaches, first of all, involve cognitive activation, so encouraging people to do repetitive cognitive exercises with the knowledge that research shows that actually doing this does create brain changes and improvements in brain functioning. So there are apps for this that are freely accessible that you can encourage people to be practicing. So I know that apps like Elevate and Lumosity offer free brain training versions. But there's also things that people can just do in their day-to-day life that challenges them.
Do you worry that people using those apps might become disheartened and that might worsen the cycle?
It's definitely a risk. And I think that if you are encouraging people to use an app, that it's good to check in with them about that, because particularly thinking about their core symptoms of depression, that if they're kind of faced with failure doing these tasks, then that would obviously mean that they'll start avoiding them as well. So being able to keep on kind of hammering home the message that the more you practice, the better you'll get, and you just need to stick with it, can be helpful.
And would you as a therapist perhaps go into that app and try to find the right level so that the person doesn't get overly challenged early in the course of this practice and feel failure and then give up?
I think I'm not sure about those apps in terms of whether you can adjust the level or whether they automatically adjust, but I know that there are some brain training apps like Happy Neuron that do adjust automatically to about an 80% accuracy so that people feel like they're doing well, but they also are being challenged. If you don't have that option, if you don't have an app that automatically adjusts, then a good idea would be getting the person to sit in front of you and do some of these tests just to check that they're not doing a test that or a task that's just too difficult or too easy for them.
And I know, I think you were going to come onto this, you've been very interested in the issue of trying to bridge these sorts of exercises so that the people go out and then do exercises in their everyday life and get more cognitively active and perhaps develop a sense of confidence. So what sort of practical everyday life things can people do to try to improve their cognitive exercise?
The pure cognitive remediation programs that we do, as well as this repetitive practice that we get them to do on a computer, also involves giving people strategies for how they might be able to improve their performance on these tasks. So, for example, in the memory domain, there's lots of strategies that you can give people. Things like repetition, saying aloud things that you want to remember, chunking, so kind of breaking lots of information down into smaller, more memorable chunks. So all of these strategies you can use that then you can talk about how you use those in your day-to-day life as well. So, for example, rather than relying on your cell phone or writing lists to remember things, it might be that you encourage someone, for example, to go to a supermarket without a shopping list and try to remember all the food that they have to buy by using these strategies.
I would never do that because I would come back with half the shopping and then I'd have to go back again. How do you motivate people to actually do that?
I think it goes back to that metaphor of seeing your brain as something that you need to train and to keep healthy, just like your body going to the gym and doing things, you know, eating the right foods to make it stay healthy. Obviously, you don't want to use that strategy for everything in your day-to-day life. In your job, it might be a problem. Another example is these days, as we're getting so reliant on phones, people have kind of lost the ability to actually navigate through a city to find a location. So if you're trying to train someone's spatial memory, it might be that you get them to look at a map to begin with, but then don't use that to get to the location rather than relying on someone telling you what road to turn down.
Yeah, and I think we saw one of our keynote speakers talk about the London taxi driver study where the size of the hippocampus, I think, increased after London taxi drivers memorized the routes throughout the whole of London, which is quite impressive, really. Which sort of brings me on to the subject of the issue of the younger age of onset of dementia in bipolar disorder. So obviously at some point in the course of this illness and in the course of potentially clinicians screening for and trying to help with cognitive problems, we may be running into an issue of patients beginning to suffer from dementia. And that's clearly something we should all be aware of. Katie, have you got any comments on that and how you might monitor that?
I think that, I mean, there are screening questionnaires out there that are used to screen for dementia, but I think taking a kind of a longitudinal perspective would be helpful. So doing cognitive testing every year or every 6 months to see whether there's a gradual decline over time would be the probably most feasible way.
And it's worth noting in that regard the data that suggests that maybe lithium might delay that early onset of dementia in bipolar disorder. So look, I think we've covered a lot of issues here. And to summarize, it's a very important issue that we should be screening for in our patients and asking them, and perhaps asking their relatives, Katie as well, and for informants.
Yeah, I think definitely family or key support people have a good way of giving us information more objectively about how people are functioning in their day-to-day life and the other factors that might be involved as well.
When we've screened for it, we need to address it by carefully appraising the patient's clinical state and their medication that they might be on. But we may come to a point where really we feel that we have to deal with this by more psychological means. Perhaps I should add at that point that, of course, there has been a number of studies looking at drugs which might be pro-cognitive for people with mood disorders. And at the moment, there's nothing really suggesting that there's a standout candidate. There's 4-deoxetine perhaps improves cognition in a couple of domains in depression. But the methodology of studies of testing cognitive effects of antidepressants has been problematic over a number of years. So it may be that other drugs do that to some extent as well. There's a very preliminary study of modafinil, and certainly Professor McIntyre in his talk at the conference suggested that drugs like modafinil and perhaps even, and obviously armodafinil, which has been trialled in bipolar disorder, and perhaps methylphenidate may be appropriate treatments for people with anhedonia and lack of drive and also perhaps cognitive problems. But if we are unable to shift this problem with those sorts of treatments and conventional treatment, then we are into this issue of trying to help the patient much more practically, perhaps by set exercises and generalizing to everyday life, exercises that people can do in everyday life. So I think that's a summary of what we've talked about today. Katie, is there anything else that we need to add, do you think, to this complex issue?
No, nothing that I can think of.
Well, I hope that has been a useful run through this really quite challenging topic that's become much more topical recently as people have realised the extent of cognitive problems for people with mood disorders. I'd really like to thank Katie for that really interesting practical advice and advice on screening for this issue, and I hope everybody's enjoyed this conference from Queenstown. Thank you very much.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Psych Matters. Feel free to share it with others and keep an eye out for future episodes. Psych Matters is produced by the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Psychiatrists.